This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy.
Gary Lachman, welcome to Sphinx Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here, or on the radio, at least.
On Sphinx Radio, right. And you have a new book out, Gary. It's called Politics and the Occult, the Left, the Right, and the Radically Unseen. It's put out by Quest Books, and that came out in 2008. Is that correct?
I think it came out just before the last presidential election.
Oh, okay, very good. So November of 2008, that would have been. Yeah, I have it here. That's right, 2008. Now, Gary, this is a really great book. I highly recommend it, and it's packed with information. And there's a lot of different directions we could go with this because you covered a lot of material. Is just to start off, is there any general comments you'd like to make about this book?
Well, I think just to say that what got me on the idea in the first place, there was a book written in the 1970s by a little known. Because he was brilliant, historian of the occult or esoteric movements, a fellow named James Webb, and it was a book called The Occult Establishment, and he was one of the early ones to look at a lot of the occult movements of the 19th century and the early 20th century from a political perspective, and he saw this as sort of what he called this kind of retreat from modernity, this sort of reaction to the rise of the modern world. And one of the points he makes, though, is that although there is very often a link between some occult thought and some rather conservative, far-right, perhaps even fascistic political sensibilities, that's not always the case. But at the time when Webb's book came out, that was also the time when there was sort of the beginning of what you can call the occult Nazi sort of genre, when there were quite a few books coming out about the whole supposed link between the rise of National Socialism and various occult sort of ideas and so on. And one of the things I wanted to sort of bring out in the book was that, that's true to some extent, although a great deal of the material about the Nazis and Hitler and so on and the occult is sort of more fantasy than actual fact, apparently, that there's also been sort of an interest in what we can call a more progressive kind of occult political thought. There were quite a few figures that were involved in more left-oriented, that say left of center rather than far right. But having said that, that's sort of I'm open to any approach you want to take to it.
Well, very good, Gary. Those are some great background comments on how you wrote the book. Now, there's one group I'd like to, if you could give us a thumbnail sketch of that you covered extensively in your book, called the Rosicrucian Group.
Oh, and, Rosicrucians, right.
Right, and now people are very familiar with the Freemasons, which is another fraternity, but from what your book said, the Rosicrucian groups were very influential as well. Could you give us just a brief breakdown of who they were and what influence they had?
Well, who they were is a good question, because there's some debate over whether they existed at all, or whether it was all a hoax. But the Rosicrucian, the idea of the Rosicrucian sort of enters history in the 1600s, early 1614, as a matter of fact, in Germany, and in a town called Kassel, this pamphlet appeared announcing the existence of this secret society, the Rosicrucians, the Brothers of the Rosy Cross, and they were followers of the philosophy and ideals of a fellow named Christian Rosenkreuz, who a century earlier, a little bit more than a century earlier, had traveled in what we would call the Near East. It was sort of the journey to the East then, but it was pretty much North Africa and Morocco and Egypt and places of that sort. And he encountered several individuals there, and he gathered a great deal of hermetic, esoteric, sort of secret knowledge. And so the story was that Christian Rosenkreuz came back to Europe with all this knowledge that he had gathered in the East, esoteric knowledge, and he wanted to set about reforming basically Europe, reforming its spiritual life, its social and political and religious life, and so on. But no one was really interested. All of the people that he approached, all the intellectuals of the time and political figures and so on, they were they just didn't want to know about the wisdom that he had gathered in the East. And so he started this small group, this small brotherhood, and there were not many of them to begin with. And he built a holy city and a sort of place where they met every year. And at the end of his life, they all separated and went out and into the world to try and bring the knowledge that Christian Risen Christ had gathered to bring it to the rest of Europe. And over the years, he had become forgotten until the authors, the Rosicrucian pamphlets themselves, they were its brothers. These people had come across to this secret room, this vault, in which they had discovered the body of Christian Risen Christ that was perfectly preserved, and also various books and materials and implements of an esoteric nature. And these fellows who had found this vault of Christian Risen Christ, they announced themselves as starting the Society of the Rosy Cross, and they put up these pamphlets in Cassel and other places, and basically say, this is the beginning of a new dawn, a new age in Europe, and they wanted to sort of free Germany from basically the domination of Rome, of the Catholic Church. And this is around the same time as the Protestant Reformation, and in fact the Rosicrucian movement was key, was linked to the whole Protestant Reformation that was going on at the time. And saying that, and basically said, if anyone is interested in learning about this knowledge and helping us, reform and change and bring great changes and bring on the new age in Europe, please get in touch with us. And, as you would think, a lot of people would be interested in that. And a lot of people did try to find these Rosicrucians, but they were nowhere to be found. No one could find any of the Rosicrucians. They were they turned out to be, as they were called, invisible. People start to think, they can't be seen, they're invisible, and this initially increased their allure and their mysteriousness, but over time people said, well, they're invisible because they don't really exist. So that in itself is a particular question, who are they? But it's thought that at least one of the authors was a fellow named Johann Valentin Andre, who was a Lutheran, but also a student of alchemy and other hermetic sciences, and that he claimed that he actually had authored some of the Rosicrucian treatises. There were more than one, but it was what he called a ludibrium, which was a serious joke. It was kind of a trick, but a trick for a serious purpose. And in a way, by pretending that these Rosicrucian brothers existed, and in a way he sort of created them, because people who were attracted to these ideas began to come out and to contact each other, and in a certain sense to form the very thing that in its own right didn't really exist.
Oh, very good. So even though they technically did not exist, people took up this very strange cause. And how influential were they in European politics and monarchy and things of that nature?
Well, they were what a friend of mine called the occult wing of the Protestant Reformation. They became, in the sense that their writings were taken by those who understood it to be in support of the anti-papal, the anti-Roman, anti-Romish movement, and that they were calling for, this new age of religious freedom, and it was a and they themselves considered themselves Christian, but they had this broader, what we would consider more spiritual on this esoteric notion of Christianity that wasn't as authoritarian and so dogmatic as the time coming out of Rome. And there was this great hope that Frederick of the Palatinate. There's a tremendous amount of sort of politics involved here with the Habsburg monarchy and challenges to it, and the perhaps support of England on the side of the Habsburg challenger, which didn't happen in the end. And there are all these what ifs. And there was a famous battle called the Battle of the White Mountain, in which Frederick, who was king of Bohemia, who basically put himself forward as a challenger against the Habsburgs, and who was seen and not prophesied, but sort of alluded to in some of the Rosicrucian literature. And so his challenge to the Habsburg was linked with this idea of this new, more progressive, liberal, in all ways, in science, in religion, in social life, and so on, this more sort of liberal view of things. So, yeah, in that sense, the Rosicrucian idea was very influential. But then Frederick was defeated, the Habsburgs triumph, the whole challenge to them was smashed, and many of the people who I had high hopes for that dispersed throughout Europe. Andre went from writing these very obscure esoteric treaties, went to writing very well on the surface very straightforward sort of Christian works, and he's started and helped to start a variety of different sort of Christian societies that, again, they wanted to bring what they considered to be a more pure, a more true Christian practice than what they saw as the kind of decadent style, you know, that was coming out of Rome. But the other side of that was the educative side, because the Rosicrucian ethos had very much to do with learning and knowledge and science and sharing that knowledge, spreading it, making it available to all researchers and everyone interested in it. And one of the people to come out of this was a fellow named Comenius, who was a Czechoslovakian, Bohemian educator, philosopher, hermetic philosopher, but also, you know, a philosopher a scientist in the line of what we would consider straightforward Western science. And he was behind a great many educational reforms that are still in operation today. So one of the things that I hope comes out from the books, and I've tried to do this in other books as well, is get an idea of how many of these ideas that, you know, we call the occult and have this kind of woo-woo X-file atmosphere around them in the popular sensibility actually were quite influential in mainstream Western history and culture.
Oh, yeah, amazing.
They're not as marginal as we tend to think.
Well, could you give us, like, a final thing? What happened to the Rosicrucians? Why are they, like, now groups calling themselves that, advertising?
I mean, the people, I mean, the thing is, it gets picked up later on.
Yeah.
I mean, the actual people, by after the defeat of Frederick and all that, I mean, fairly soon after, I mean, it's Rosicrucians start out as kind of a half-myth, and then they become actually, you know, this ingredient in this ongoing Western sort of counter tradition, the Western esoteric tradition, the tradition that I sort of, how should we say, it didn't start, but it began to take a particular turn with the rise of science. It became sort of the alternative reality tradition. And so the Rosicrucians become this sort of figure in there, this icon in there. So many people go back and, you know, start calling themselves Rosicrucians or start, you know, making links to it. Later philosophers like Robert Fludd, in England, and Michael Mayer in Germany, who are hermetic alchemical thinkers, they in spirit consider themselves Rosicrucians, although they tried to contact them, the actual, you know, concrete people, but they can never find them and all that. So it becomes this kind of standard trope. And by the time you get to the late 19th, early 20th century, you have, you know, different groups calling themselves Rosicrucian groups. But the, I mean, they basically have picked the name, and it's not, there isn't any real historical link.
No. It's just mail-order mysticism.
I mean, there's very little of that sort of thing. I mean, many people have this idea that there's some, you know, continuity going back. I mean, there is, in some ways, in spirit, an idea in the zeitgeist, but not in any sort of real concrete, you know, the same group existing for the last 2 centuries, the last 2,000 years or something like that. I mean...
No, just wanted you to comment on that. Now, just to subject hop a bit, maybe you could give us a breakdown of the traditionalist movement, which you cover in Politics and the Occult, the Left, the Right, and the Radically Unseen Quest Books, 2008. People, listeners can get it on Amazon.com. And is there any webpage you would like to give out for your work?
I don't have a web. I've been something I'm meaning to do for ages. We just haven't gotten around to it. I mean, there's a couple excerpts from the book on, there's a site called RealitySandwich.com,
okay.
And there's a couple excerpts from the book there. I mean, there's a blog. I have a blog on that. So.
Oh, very good. RealitySandwich.com.
Reality Sandwich. And later this week, there's another site called The Daily Grail, and they're putting up another sort of excerpt from.
Oh, very good. By the way, you mentioned The Daily Grail. Adam Scott Miller, who is their artist, is also the artist for my book publishing company, Mystic Valley. And Adam, there's some great news. He just got into an art show this January 2009 with Alex Gray, the famous New York art. So Adam Scott Miller of The Daily Grail is now being billed alongside with Alex Gray. And I just wanted to he just got his MFA from the Mass College of Art, partially based on the cover he did for my book. But seeing as you brought up The Daily Grail, I just wanted to... That's where I discovered Adam Scott Miller, and I just wanted to congratulate him on all his great work. Now, just to move on, could you give us that breakdown of the traditionalist movement?
Well, I'm not a scholar in the traditionalist, but I do touch on some aspects of a couple thinkers or writers associated, you know, with them. Or,
sure.
Or one is,
and you did a very good job too. Yeah.
Esoteric philosopher, I guess you would call him. And I mean the central theme from the traditionalists is the way I approach them in the book, or how they're pivotal to the book is they're very staunch anti modernism or anti modern world stance. I'm trying to think. There's the book I think Crisis of the Modern World or something along those lines. There's another fellow that I talked about, the Italian Julius Evola, who was a sort of student of Gingon's. He had his own take on things as well, and he was more overtly political. He tried to ingratiate himself both with Mussolini's fascist regime and also with the Nazis. But it's this kind of very radical rejection of modernity, and the idea that in the dim past there was some primal revelation of the higher metaphysical world, you know, the world of being, the real world, to humans at some time. And there was some the perennial philosophy, this perennial wisdom, this teaching that subsequently became, you know, it deteriorated, it became watered down, it became diluted in a variety of ways, and what we know as the organized religions of today, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, and so on, these are different streams that have come out of this primal revelation. And for Gingon and for most of the other traditionalists, I mean, everything has basically gone downhill. From day one, you know, they had this whole sense that, you know, there was this. Well, they're all keyed into the ideas of the Yugas, and you know, there's the Golden Age and the Silver Age and the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, which is the Kali Yuga, was what we were supposed to be in now. This is, you know, the worst possible times, and it's the furthest away from the. You know, the great spiritual revelation, but the idea is that at the end of it, there'll be return, the wheel turns around, and there's a kind of new beginning with going back to a new golden age. But in terms of the book, I mean, Gainon has this. I mean, in one sense, he wants to save the West because he doesn't believe in the spiritual value of the West, even though it's. In decline for him pretty much since the Renaissance. But he has this idea that a core elite who have insight into this tradition, this herb primal tradition, would be able to, you know, working behind the scenes, working covertly, would be able to prepare modern democratic Western society for this transition that's going to take place. They'd be able to sort of lead it and guide it. And I mean, that's a particularly, you know, anti-democratic, anti-egalitarian. It's a kind of conspiratorial idea that, you know, many people have felt to in many ways be the case in the States, you know, for the last 8 years. Hoping that it's going to be something different now that there's a new president in.
Well, we hope anyway. I mean, Gainon wasn't all wrong.
Yeah, power to him. You know, God, you know, I don't envy him. I wouldn't want his job, put it that way. But, getting back to what I said earlier about James Webb, the historian, saying that a great deal of occult, of interest in the occult and occult ideas and groups grew out of this sort of reaction to modernity. And so the traditional sort of embodied this complete rejection of modernity in all its forms. But for myself, I mean, I have to admit, and it's ironic that, I mean, I'm a product of modernity myself, and I say this in the book, and I'm not so much defending it and championing it, but just recognizing, you know, the truth that, well, I mean, I'm not a product of a tradition. I don't have the kind of roots in some sort of, you know, long-standing, continual spiritual practice. I'm certainly a product of urban civilization. I'm one of the rootless monads that many of the critics of the modern world, contemporary age, point to, you know, this sense of rootlessness. You know, there's not a real community. Mm-hmm. There's not a real spiritual sort of union. And you know, many of those perceptions and criticisms are accurate. But what troubles me about sort of some aspects of what the traditional response to it would mean, and this is especially so with the work of this Italian writer, Judith Evola, is that a kind of very strict authoritarian sort of, you know, almost caste-like system of society would be needed to be put in place in order to actualize the kind of spiritual civilization that these thinkers envision. And there's many aspects of that sort of spiritual society that they have in mind that are appealing, but they contrast with my equally attractive, even more attractive notions of sort of personal liberty and freedom, and so on and so on. And so, in many ways, I come out in the end saying, "Well, I for all of its problems, for all of the shopping malls, and you know, global warming, and a variety of other ills in the modern world, in the long run, I have to say I feel more comfortable with that, a world that would allow for, you know, something like shopping malls, even though I hate them, rather than the kind of spiritual authoritarian societies envisioned by someone like Gainon or Nebula. And in some ways, in a very dark, morbid, bizarre way, you know, tried to be implemented in Nazi Germany.
Oh, yeah, I mean...
Can I ask you a question?
Oh, yeah, it really does, and I appreciate your perspective. What they're calling for is actually very, very harsh and quite hard, and even they would say ultimately unattainable, like Ananda Kimura Swami or some of the other ones. They'd say, like, you know, you can't be a Luddite either. You can't, you know, reject the whole modern world. But I certainly appreciate, the misuse of power in the Third Reich and in fascist Italy, which was really, as you say, the only real attempts to bring this into political fruition were obviously, you know, nightmares. And I don't particularly subscribe to what happened.
The other side of it, the kind of enforced, say, egalitarianism that, say, happened in the Soviet Union, let's say, were equally nightmares. So, I mean, that, you know, it's not, I consider myself neither right or left, which is easy to say, but it's not easy to come up with any sort of alternative to those things, even though I think both of those perspectives on politics are kind of used up by now.
Oh, yeah.
And we're all hoping for some kind of new thing to emerge.
Well, I always like what Alan Watts said.
The idea in the book is sort of walk a line between the two and say, well, here's the problem with the excesses on this side, here's the problem with the excesses on this side.
Yeah.
Here are some elements of this side that actually do seem attractive. And, you know, and so on and so on. And, I mean, in a way, I'm trying to do this kind of metaphysical, you know, fence-sitting with the aim of making clear that, I mean, the real threat, what's tragic about this, and tragic in the grand sense, is that oftentimes it's the clash of two good things, you know, rather than some obvious evil and some obvious good. You know, this is what makes it difficult when, you know, say something simple like, you know, the clash between the notion of some sort of hierarchy or some sort of egalitarian society, hierarchical, you know, egalitarian. You know, it's today, being, you know, politically correct, more or less, we tend to think, you know, okay, the egalitarian is actually what's, you know, preferable. But, it, you know, I think in all honesty, if you look at these things, you can see, like, well, actually, there's aspects of, there's problematics in that, and there are actually desirable things in this notion of hierarchy in some sense. And it's really difficult to approach these things. What I tried to do in this, I tried to make it a good read, but I also tried to take the idea seriously. And it's a different, most books written about politics and cult tend to be sensational, you know. Revelations like, oh, you know, so-and-so was interested in astrology or something like that, which, you know, makes for good gossip, but I'm more interested in some of the ideas that clash with the introduction of these two things.
Right. Well, I always like what Alan Watts said. Taking sides in contemporary politics is like taking sides with inmates in a mental institution over a dispute. So I don't particularly. I guess I would label myself a survivalist because that's really all you're left with the way things, if you're breathing, you're lucky, because out of the 7 billion people on this planet, you know, a lot of them live in misery and squalor, and I'm not particularly saying any political ideology. I'm not saying there's any solution at all, which is, you know, it's kind of, you're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to take sides with somebody, but it's difficult to do, as you can see in your book. It's really, like you say, there are great ideas and good things out there, and it's okay to embrace particular issues, and, you know, like the environment or healthcare. But it's tough to latch on to any political group these days or any political ideology. Yeah. It's tough, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So, Gary, just to close up a little. We've done a half hour, and I've gotten, really a great packed half hour of solid information. And I'd like to just touch upon a few of your other books, which I've read, which are very good, that I'd also like to recommend. Your History of Consciousness was excellent. That was a very good read. Excellent information, stuff in there I hadn't seen before, and the book I just finished of yours now, I'm working on a book on the Beatles and the occult, And I just read Turn Off Your Mind about the 1960s. And these are other Gary Lachman books which are really worth taking a look at. And are there any projects you're working on now that are coming out after this Politics and the Occult book?
Well, I'm currently working on a book on Jung for Penguin in the U.S. I'm just doing the research for it at the moment, so that won't be out until at the earliest next year sometime. That's the next thing in the pipeline.
Oh, very good. I'd love to see your work on Jung. Now, one thing you do cover in here is you cover some of the Jungians in the United States, like Joe Campbell and people like that. Are you going to cover them in your book, or are you going to focus more on Carl Jung?
It's aimed to be a sort of introductory life story of Jung, and then going into from the perspective of him being from the perspective of his occult, mystical, so-called sort of interests, in recent times he's been sort of taken to task for his. Jung himself, throughout his whole career, he denied he was a mystic, and he was always affirming that he was a scientist and he was an empiricist and so on. And he had no doctrine, and it was all observation and so on. But it's clear to anyone who's familiar with his work and his life that he certainly had some remarkable experiences that not everyone has. And in doing books on people like Rudolf Steiner, and I did a book on P.D. Uspensky, who's a Russian philosopher who's probably most known for being a follower of Gurdjieff. I also did a book on Swedenborg, the sage. And doing books on all those, I found myself thinking, well, actually, there's quite a lot of similarities between these three, avowed spiritual or esoteric or mystical, whatever you want to call them, occult thinkers. And so the idea is sort of to look at Jung's career and life from the point of view of him, being a mystic, let's say, or something along those sorts of lines. So that's sort of the general thing. I've just been reading as much material as I get my hands on. Fairly soon I've got to start putting pixels to screen. One used to say, get it on paper, but people don't get it on paper anymore these days. So,
well, we're a bit older. Yeah, I'm 44, so I remember the old clunker typewriters back in the day. Yeah. Well, we're about out of time, Gary.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate your calling, and I appreciate being on the show.
Very good, and I just want to give out your book once more. It's Politics and the Occult, The Left, the Right, and the Radically Unseen. It is by Quest Books. You can get it on Amazon.com. And thank you for being on Sphinx Radio.
My pleasure.